Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin DNR. Preventing food waste and composting scraps and uneaten veggies, grains, and fruit can help the environment. More dnr.wi.gov by searching food waste.
Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
It's one thing to write a complicated piece of journalism when you have a willing subject and full access. Obviously, it's a whole lot tougher when you don't. Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the senior legal analyst at CNN. He's had a lot of experience writing stories about people who do not want to be written about. Most recently, Patty Hearst. So, quick refresher. In 1974, Patty Hearst, the heir to the Hearst family fortune, was kidnapped from her college apartment by the Symbionese Liberation Army. This was a group of would-be leftist revolutionaries. 2 months later, they released a recording of Patty saying she was joining their cause. This shocked the world. And then came the famous photo of Patty Hearst helping rob a bank while brandishing a machine gun. And later, in the trial, after they were all captured, Patty said she'd been brainwashed by the group's leader, Donald DeFries. But was she? Doug Gordon sat down to talk with Jeff Toobin about his investigation of the story in his new book, American Heiress.
The heart of this story is whether Patricia Hearst was brainwashed or whether she went along voluntarily with the Symbionese Liberation Army. And throughout your book, you write about what you believe was going through Hearst's mind during this entire ordeal. Were you able to interview her?
I wasn't. I tried very hard. I wrote, I called. I had one conversation with her, which I can recount in its entirety. After many electronic and letter writing approaches failed, I just called her. I had her number, and she answered the phone, and I said, "Hi, Patricia, this is Jeff Toobin." And she said, "Oh, God, click." So I sort of got the picture that she wasn't interested in cooperating. That was too bad, but as I write in an author's note in the book, I had many vehicles, many opportunities to get her thinking on this case, whether through her book, her testimony, her various interviews with the FBI and others. So, of course, I would have preferred to interview her, but I did feel like I knew in substantial detail what she thought about these underlying events.
This is a big challenge that you undertook with this book. On the one hand, you're a journalist, and yet at the same time, it seems to me like you're trying to do a novelist job by inhabiting a character who happens to be a real person, Patricia Hearst.
And a woman.
Yeah, and a woman. So how are you able to balance these different approaches and conflicting approaches while you were writing the book?
Well, you know, I thought a lot about that question. The guiding principle that I operated by, to the extent I can articulate it, is, you know, there are a lot of buzzwords associated with this case, most famously brainwashing and Stockholm syndrome. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to avoid use of those terms in part because they are journalistic, not medical, and don't have specific psychiatric meanings. But more importantly, I thought it would be better to focus on what actually happened. What did Patricia do? What did all the other people do and say? Because that, I felt like I was in a good position to recount. You know, I felt less confident in my ability to articulate what people were thinking and why they were thinking that. I mean, I didn't foreclose that altogether. Obviously, I do discuss that to a certain extent, but I wanted to focus on sort of the journalistic basics of the story rather than the speculative part of it.
Mm-hmm. Were there times at all where you found yourself struggling with ethical dilemmas in terms of what you were doing?
I did. I mean, there was one moment in particular, one issue in particular that I was particularly sensitive about and thought about a lot how to portray it, and that's Patricia's claim that she was sexually assaulted while in the first period after she was kidnapped in February of 1974. Because in her book, she claims that Donald DeFries, the leader of the group, and Willie Wolf, who the SLA asserts was her lover, forced themselves on her sexually. The SLA survivors basically agree with most everything Patricia says about the nature of the kidnapping and her captivity, except they assert in the most vociferous way that she was never sexually assaulted and any sexual conduct she had, particularly with Willie Wolfe, was consensual. And that dilemma, that contradiction, was an area where I felt I needed to tread especially carefully.
So how did you go about doing that? How did you tread carefully?
Mostly, I just was candid with the reader and said, you know, on most issues, there's really not dispute about what happened. But here, there is one. Federal prosecutors later claimed that Patricia fabricated this story. Having covered many sexual assault cases for television and in print, I am aware of the sensitivity of the issue. Also, the frequent claim that women make this up, which is usually false. Also, you know, in the 1970s, the idea of what consent means in a sexual context was very different than it is today. In those days, a man couldn't be convicted of rape unless the woman had forcibly resisted. And the whole idea of whether a woman who has been kidnapped and being held in a closet can be said meaningfully to consent to sex, I think we look at that in a very different prism than we did in 1974.
It seems like what this book has in common with your other books, your book about O.J. Simpson, The Run of His Life, and your other books, is that you carved out this certain kind of investigative project for yourself. In your books, it seems to me that you're writing about subjects that we think we know, but then you give us a different perspective. Is that the way you see your work?
One of my mentors in journalism, Michael Kinsley, said, there are only two stories worth writing. One is, it's worse than you think, and the other is, everything you thought you knew is wrong. I don't go quite that far. But one of the things I have learned, especially, you know, it came to light very much this year in this sort of O.J. Simpson revival, the wonderful FX series based on my book and the terrific ESPN documentary, is that even when people think they know the whole story, they don't. I mean, I know the O.J. Simpson story as well as anybody, and I was riveted and fascinated and highly informed by Ezra Edelman's documentary. I didn't know a lot of that stuff. And I think when we are interested in a story, we have the curiosity to find out more about it. And so I never really buy the argument that, oh, you know, people are sick of it and they know everything. If people are interested enough to be sick of it, they're interested enough to see another good version of it.
I renounce my class privilege, and I would never choose to live the rest of my life surrounded by pigs like the Hearsts. Patria o muerte, venceremos. Death to the fascist insect that preys upon the life of the people.
So after Patricia Hearst was kidnapped, the SLA took a photo of her that became one of the most famous images of the 1970s. Can you describe it for me?
It's a photograph of Patricia holding a machine gun against a backdrop of the red SLA flag, which had a seven-headed cobra on it. In the book, I describe this photograph, you know, not facetiously, as the Mona Lisa of the 1970s because, as in the famous painting, Patricia's expression is inscrutable. You can study this picture for a long time, as I certainly have, and you can see her as terrified, you can see her as proud, you can see her as happy, you can see her as sad, you can see her as ready to fight. It is almost a perfect metaphor for the mystery of her captivity as a whole, because you just can't know for sure what she's thinking or feeling in that photograph.
What do you see her as in that photo?
Well, I see her as a revolutionary fighter. I see her as a comrade. When you see what was going on, it was right around the time of the first bank robbery. You see that she was increasingly left alone by the other SLA members because they weren't worried about her running away. She was a participant in the bank robbery, as the jury in her case found. She was in love with Willie Wolfe, who was one of the kidnappers. And this moment in late April of 1974, before the group moved to Los Angeles, was their most successful time because, as they hoped and predicted, the photographs of Patricia in the bank wielding a machine gun caused a national sensation.
Yeah. One of the key incidents in this whole story happened at a sporting goods store in Inglewood, California on May 16th, 1974. Can you tell me about that?
Well, the bank robbery was April 15th, and the heat got intense from the police in San Francisco, so they fled. There were nine of them at that point, to Los Angeles, Donald DeFries' hometown. And they rented a little house, and they started to go a little stir-crazy. So on May 16th, three of the nine decided to go shopping, Bill and Emily Harris and Patricia. And they went to a grocery store, and they went to a newsstand, and then they went to Mel's Sporting Goods to get some clothes. And Bill and Emily went inside, leaving Patricia across four lanes of traffic in a parked van with the key in the ignition and her with complete freedom. She could have driven away. She could have walked away. She could have called the police. She could have called home. But she stayed in the van while Bill and Emily went inside. Now, because Bill is a genius, Bill decided to shoplift in the store. And the clerk, as it happened, was an aspiring police officer, Anthony Shepard. And Anthony Shepard knew that the crime of shoplifting does not take place until the individual actually leaves the premises of the store. So he sort of shadowed Bill in the store. But when Bill went outside, Anthony tackled him. And then Emily Harris jumped in. And then there was this melee in front of Mel's Sporting Goods with Patricia across the street. So what does Patricia do? Does she run away? Does she drive away? Does she do nothing? No. Patricia goes into the back of the van, picks up a machine gun, pokes it out the window, and shoots up the whole facade of Mel's Sporting Goods in an effort to free her colleagues, which she does. And Bill and Emily extricate themselves from Anthony Shepard and get in the van, and the three of them drive off. Now, it's my view that this act of shooting up Mel's Sporting Goods is as vivid and clear a demonstration of Patricia's loyalties at this point as anything she said much, much later. And that's why I think it's such an important event in the history of the case.
Yeah. What is Patricia Hearst like now?
You know, one of the amazing aspects of this whole story is that she has led the life for which she was destined. She is a wealthy lady in the suburbs. She, you know, is a mother. She's a grandmother. Unfortunately, she's a widow. She is conservative, like most of the Hearsts are conservative. And you know, the whole thing, and I'm not trying to be flip, but it's like the whole thing was like the junior year abroad from hell. But she has led the life for which she was destined, which again may seem surprising, but it's also, you know, predictable in a way. Despite our best efforts and hopes, you know, we all sort of turn into our parents, and that's what happened to her too.
Jeffrey Toobin is the author of American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crimes, and Trial of Patty Hearst. He also wrote the book that inspired the hit TV series about O.J. Simpson's trial, The Run of His Life. He talked with Doug Gordon.